This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey everybody!
Yo.
The dulcet tones of Matt Tebbe is what you're listening to there. Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. My name is Ben Sternke. I'm here with Matt Tebbe, who's humming.
I'm here
He's just sort of humming
song,
today.
I got the song stuck in my head, and
that happens.
I put these headphones on and speak in this microphone, and I can actually I can hear my hum a lot.
Yeah, you can hear your hum. It's nice.
Yeah.
Very good, friends. Welcome to another episode of our series, Being a Christian in the USA. Being a Christian in America. Today we've got an interview with David Swanson, who wrote a book called Rediscipling the White Church. It's all about racism and whiteness and how that affects our discipleship. And
yes.
Matt, you were just sharing with me that he was getting, as you put it, dragged on social media.
Yeah, just he's getting... So David Swanson, white pastor, he's pastors in a multicultural congregation. He's lived in a multi-ethnic neighborhood for decades in Chicago. Great guy, great book about how racism isn't a cultural issue, it's a theological, spiritual formation issue.
Boom.
And I'm telling you, that like as white Christians, if we could just reckon with the fact that racism is a theological crisis for us,
yeah,
and a discipleship crisis for us,
Things would stop
getting worse. I'll tell you that.
Yes, yes. Things would start turning around. Yeah, totally. I feel like some of what I've been learning lately. I put this in one of our curated links lately, and I've heard you say something similar, Matt. Just that, as we have, and I'll just speak for myself as a white person, kind of gotten into the fray here of treating this seriously as a theological issue.
Mm-hmm.
We are getting a bit of pushback from people who don't see it as a theological issue, or don't want to see it as a theological issue, want to see it as a cultural issue, or people who, they think that we need to kind of do the both sides thing, and that kind of a thing. Sort of people stuck within the binary who are afraid, I think sometimes legitimately, of, going down some, this is slippery slope argument, basically, right? You're going to become Marxist or whatever if you start treating racism seriously as a theological issue.
Yeah.
But anyway, somebody said something on a call I was part of the other day that said, they quoted Martin Luther King Jr., who said that in this kind of fight against injustice, in advocating for justice, racial justice, that we need to build up our spiritual fortitude. We need to become more resilient in the face of opposition.
We do.
That kind of thing.
I do.
Yes, I do too. And I was just realizing how quickly I get fatigued and discouraged when I get the slightest little bit of pushback, And anyway, I was reading Hebrews 12 the other day, And N.T. Wright's translation is quite fun sometimes. And he, you know, in Hebrews 12, they have that little line there about how consider Jesus, who endured, and the phrase that N.T. Wright used was, consider him who endured such enormous opposition. And if you like let that weigh on your mind, it'll prevent you from becoming worn out and weary. I've been thinking about that, of just how like I have this need to build up spiritual fortitude. And it's not just this stuff, but it was a bunch of other stuff happening this week that for me sort of caused me, this is like all culminating Thursday night. We have a discipleship group in our church that I lead with my wife. Mm-hmm. And Thursday night, we got to this discipleship group, and we did a little check-in before we started, and every single person, including me, was just feeling down and discouraged about, you know, a lot of different things. And as we proceeded through just doing the thing that we do in our discipleship groups, which is just to pay attention to what God's doing, mm-hmm. pay attention to how he's at work in our lives, you know, in the midst of the discouragement, in the midst of, you know, feeling down and depressed about things. Like in the midst of those things, talking about those things, and we uncovered, you know, how God was at work in this one particular person's life. And I found myself by the end of that meeting feeling so energized, just so energized by, and I think what I'm realizing is like the Lord like provided for me. The Lord provided what I needed as I took the step of faith of just participating in what he's doing, right? Because I think the thing that I would want to do in a moment like that is like Netflix and chill. Like that would have been my preferred, like if the weather was bad and we had to cancel the discipleship group, I'd have been like, oh, that's great. You know, then I can just, but I don't know that I would have experienced what I experienced if I hadn't have just gone through with it and said, you know what? God's here. God's at work. So anyway. I don't know. I don't know if that's clear, Matt, but it felt like a big realization for me. Like, when I participate, when I seek first the kingdom, when I participate in this stuff that God is doing, despite the discouragement, despite and it wasn't just the injustice stuff, but it was, you know, it's the pandemic, it's everything that's just sort of like feels like it's weighing me down. But I feel like that's the place where we're going to learn fortitude. This place where I'm going to learn fortitude is just keep showing up in the places where God promises to show up, where two or three are gathered, you know?
Well, we need to get to David Swanson,
but I
do want to give you some homework, Ben.
Oh,
I do want to give you some homework. You need to find a safe place without your children around and just Google Netflix and chill, because it doesn't mean watching Netflix and just hanging out on the couch.
Oh, doesn't it?
No, it does not.
I'm revealing my age here. I have no idea. That sounds like a really nice time, just sort of watching a show.
I know it does. It's it's coded language. It's coded language for like a booty call.
Okay. Oh, is it really?
Yeah, we're going to hook up.
Oh, okay. Well,
Netflix and chill is, hey, let's have sex.
I legit did not know that.
I gave you homework and then I did it for you.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's, you know, let me Google that for you. Well, you already knew what it meant, so.
Well, I spend about 3 hours a day reading Urban Dictionary just to stay hip.
Just to stay up on things, yeah. Okay.
So David Swanson interview today. This is a great, his book is awesome. I know there's a glut of racism books on the market from Christians. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen some, I mentioned he was getting dragged on social media. I think his book is great. I think what David has to share with us is great because it comes from on the ground, living with people on the margins for decades. And so the critiques he gets are mostly from people that haven't been on the ground, living among the marginalized for decades. Yeah. Listen to people with firsthand experience.
Yes. Johnny-come-lately.
Don't listen to wealthy, affluent people who pass as white people or people who parrot their talking points when it comes to racism.
Yeah.
We don't need more of that. We need more David Swanson, though. So enjoy this today. Enjoy this, this interview.
It's a great interview. And hey, if you want to check out, we've got a workshop we've planned as well.
Oh, yeah,
an online workshop.
For the first time in forever.
Called Church in the Wild. For the first time in forever. Church in the Wild, being the body of Christ when we're not in charge anymore. just what does it look like to cultivate a winsome, authentic Christian witness in the midst of post-Christendom? A lot of our instincts about witness mission are colonial, and we want to just share some of what we're learning about this. So that's November 13th and 14th. It's a Friday night and Saturday morning. It is going to be online. For more information, you can go to gravityleadership.com/church.
Yes.
And hope to see you there. We're excited about offering this as an online workshop.
Yeah.
All right. Here's David Swanson.
David Swanson, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Thanks you both for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yes.
Yeah, good to have you.
David's a pastor in Chicago, and we've been kind of longtime social media. I've been sort of a stan, you know, stalking fan of yours for a bit, and appreciated your voice from afar. And you've written a book now, so your voice is actually sitting right here on my desk. and the title of the book is Rediscipling the White Church, From Cheap Diversity to True Solidarity. David, you have just published this book, and we're in the middle of a fairly profound cultural moment with the accumulation of press and media and video of Black people being, you know, murdered, basically, every day, it seems like. So we want to jump into this book. I think it's an incredible book. But first, would you introduce yourself to our audience, what you do, what you spend your time doing?
Yeah, so I'm a church planter. Our church is celebrating 10 years this summer. We had planned a nice little celebration, and like many churches, are figuring things out week to week. And so hopefully we'll get to do that in person at some point. But God has been faithful over these 10 years. We set out to plant a multiracial church on the south side of the city because the church we were a part of was also an intentionally multiracial congregation and wanted to see new church plants around the city. And there were people from this neighborhood, the Bronzeville neighborhood in Chicago, who were a part of that church, who were, you know, basically discerning as leaders in the church that this would be a good neighborhood for that kind of a church. I did not intend to be the pastor of this church. We were all convinced that a multiracial church in a Black neighborhood needed a Black pastor, and that just was obvious to all of us. And through a long series of events, I eventually was called by that congregation to pastor the church. And very, very thankful to God for that. So I'm married for a little over 20 years, two boys. We live here on the South Side, and just love where we live, love where we get to serve. And the church itself is, you know, relatively evenly distributed: African American, Asian American, and white. Though the neighborhood that we serve is predominantly Black.
Yeah. So David, this may seem like an obvious question, but I'd love to hear you wax whimsical on it for a bit. Why did you not want to be the pastor of this church?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple things. One, the reality is that most multiracial churches in the United States are pastored by white men. And my own conviction, which I share with others, is that one of the things that marks true reconciliation in the American church landscape is when white people are willing to submit to people of color as their pastors and leaders. Yes. And so for me, one of the things I always look to in multiracial congregations is who's in leadership, and are white people, if those churches have white people in them, willing to submit to those leaders and follow their leadership. So that's a strong conviction of mine. So obviously, you know, being that person was not something that I particularly aspired to. So that theologically and sociologically, that's a piece of it. But, you know, just to be really frank, I had just profound insecurities about being able to pastor well in this context. All of the things that I perceive as my own strengths weren't particularly strong in this context, and where I was wise was not particularly helpful in this context. And so just on a personal level, it was a kind of a turning inside out experience. And I'm profoundly thankful for that now, of course, but it was a dying to self that I went into with a lot of fear and trembling.
Yeah. So you became kind of the white pastor of a multicultural church. And it sounds like that's a perfect setup for what you call cheap diversity.
Yeah, right.
Right? That's the opening salvo of a church that settles for cheap diversity. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think that when white people, and I'm a pastor, so I'm thinking about Christians particularly, when we think about reconciliation, what we tend to have in mind is a kind of representation, a diverse representation. So that white Christians tend to think about progress toward racial justice as being marked by a diverse representation in the room. So if the worship leader is a person of color, right? Or if I can look around the sanctuary and identify, you know, a handful of African American congregants, some Latino folks, well, then I, as a white person, think, well, we've made some real progress here. And there's sociological reasons behind this having to do with how we think about relationships. The problem, of course, is that the culture itself of that congregation can remain entirely white in its makeup, in its assumptions, and you still have that racial or ethnic or cultural diversity as a part of it. That's cheap diversity, and it's problematic because it does not actually honor the lived realities of the people of color in the congregations. It caters instead to the norms and the levels of comfort of the white congregants. And so at a moment like we're in right now, when there's some profound public racial trauma happening, that congregation that has some diversity in it might engage a little bit, but is still primarily concerned with the comfort of its white members.
This
communicates to everybody else in the room is that we're not actually interested in the material sources of your suffering. We're much more interested in how we in the dominant culture feel about ourselves right now.
Ben, what did you hear? How would you then summarize cheap diversity?
It seems to me that cheap diversity is, I mean, it's I don't know if this is unfair, but like it feels to me like inherently exploitative without, you know what I mean? Like without meaning to, I don't think anybody's trying, but you know, we're so formed into this that we're formed into, as white people, we're formed into being concerned about white feelings, including ours.
Yeah.
And sort of patting ourselves on the back to say, oh, look, we have some black people in our church or, you know, some diversity. We're happy about this. But that's sort of where things end for us because we don't inherently, you know, we're still inherently exploiting these black bodies for our own feelings of like, oh, see, we're woke or we're doing okay here because we've got some diversity.
No, I think that's exactly right. It's no longer appropriate in this country to be racially homogenous, to desire racial homogeneity, particularly in a church setting, right? So we've had to pay lip service to wanting diversity, to wanting reconciliation. It's just that we've never interrupted the exploiting systems of white supremacy and the kind of racialized hierarchy of our society. So we can add a little bit of this diversity and feel good about ourselves, right? Because now obviously we're not racist because I got this black friend here, right? Or you know, our worship leader is Latino or whatever the case may be. So that I think exploitative is absolutely right. We're still using people as a means to an end.
So David, your book is perhaps different than other books I've been reading or maybe our audience has been reading because you center a call for the church that this is a problem of discipleship. Right. So, and you quote Dallas Willard, who's he's near and dear to our hearts. You had me at Dallas. So, my question is like, most white people I know that want a multiracial church aren't wishing for themselves to be racist. Right. It's like we're intending to be racist or want to be racist. We just find, and in your book, you talk about how we're just formed that way. Can you unpack a bit how are we formed in racialized ways of being that cheapen diversity in our churches.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I love about Dallas Willard is that he identifies the fact that discipleship can happen in lots of different places, right? That it's not simply those of us who are Christians who are being discipled. And this is what I think white Christianity in this country has missed. We have missed the ways that we are discipled racially by our country. This is really, really important because our country is not racially neutral. Our country is built on certain assumptions that have to do with a racial hierarchy. And that's just baked into the system of our country. And this is most evident when you look at any sorts of metrics or outcomes organized by ethnicity or race. You know, white people are always going to be thriving more, going to live longer, are going to have more access to wealth, to healthcare, et cetera. We live in a country where you can accurately predict how close someone is going to live to a toxic waste site simply by their race. That's the landscape, right? And that does something to us. That is forming us on a very, very deep level. It's reinforcing this assumption about who is most fully human and who is not. That's a very sort of ugly thing to say out loud, but that's what's at work on the level of our assumptions and our desires, right? It's not cognitive. I'm not sitting here thinking those things, right?
We're not taught this in school.
Absolutely. Not in any kind of a blatant way, right? Now, on a more subtle way in terms of like what we're not taught at school, right? Or whose narratives and voices are left out. That's what's reinforcing those things. And I move through this world, not thinking one thought to the next, but navigating and through how I imagine, how I love, how I desire, right? Yeah. So that's what we have missed, that kind of malforming racial discipleship that is at work on our hearts and on our assumptions. And that's what the white church has utterly ignored.
Yeah. You mentioned this in your book too, but that's what Eddie Glaude Jr. calls the value gap.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
And there's racist ideas that contribute to the value gap. One of the books I read that kind of woke me up to this, because as a white person, I think we're conditioned to hear what you just described, all this data of racial disparity, and chalk it up to individual decisions making, your culture, i.e. black person or BIPOC, your culture doesn't look like white culture, and that's why you have these problems, right? So you don't have this, a dad in the home, or, you know, there's all these different things, right? But you quote the work of Emerson and Smith. That book just rocked me when I read that 15 years ago. And you mentioned there's conceptual tools that white people, that inhibits white people from seeing systemic racism. Could you name one or two of those? Because I think they're, I think they're super important.
And not only do they keep us from seeing it, these tools actually, the way they work is that when we attempt to pursue racial reconciliation, we actually end up doing damage oftentimes. So the tools that they identify are anti-structuralism, which is this sort of allergy to any ways of thinking about what's wrong in the world through systems or structures. Individualism, which is this sort of idea of this pure autonomous individual navigating his or her way through the world, unencumbered by system structures. And relationalism, which is when I identify something that's wrong in the world, like racial injustice, this is evidence that relationships have been broken, have been frayed. And so the fix then is that relationship. So we go back to what we were talking about earlier about cheap diversity, right? So when your tool is relationalism, if you're a part of a majority white culture church and you say, yeah, you know what, racism exists, it's out there. So what we need to do about it is make cross-racial friends.
Be nicer to black people.
Let's welcome black people into our church, right? Let's do an occasional joint service or what have you. And now I have some friends. Now I have some acquaintances. We fixed it. Maybe not quite like that, right? But that really is the assumption. Mm-hmm. And so these tools allow us to kind of pursue a form of justice that does nothing to interrupt the injustice, right? That is continuing to wreak real world havoc on bodies and communities.
Yeah, and I think I've heard, this is the reason that I've heard some people say that they actually don't like the term racial reconciliation. Mm-hmm. I know that's kind of a stand-in for a lot of, you know, what we good things that we want to see happen. But I think racial reconciliation assumes that there's these two races of people who are just not getting along and they're a little bit agitated at each other. But that's not the problem, right? The problem is hierarchical. It's That's systemic. Right. It's about justice for, it's not just two groups that are like, oh, those people are weird. I don't like them. It, you know, that would be prejudice or bias, you know, which, you know, that's an issue too, but we're talking about something much more deep, much more fundamental.
That's right.
That's that one of these groups has been considered less than human.
That's right. This is why I talk about segregation in the book. You know, white people, we love to talk about division as though there was this thing that just happened to us. We are divided. Like, okay, that's we had agency in this, right? Yeah. We participated in this. And so I think about things like housing. You know, white people tend to think about where we live as just a matter of personal preference, right? Yeah. I like to live in the suburbs or I like to live in this neighborhood in the city, what have you. In fact, where we live has this force of a history of federal, you know, policy behind it.
Right.
You know, where certain people could get federally backed loans and others couldn't, where certain people benefited from the GI Bill and others didn't. And this is how we accumulate wealth in this country. So the segregated nature of our lives and then how that works itself out into expressions of injustice is not a de facto experience, right? There's like you were saying, Ben, there's a hierarchy, there's force of government and policy and power behind that. That's what we have to actually own and acknowledge. If we're going to make a difference, we actually have to tell the truth about that stuff. Otherwise, we're going to always do this sort of bland, sort of let's get together, you know, which does nothing for anybody.
And I think it's difficult. It's difficult for people who, you know, they learn about that history, the GI Bill and the housing policies and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's hard for people to realize that they're connected. Like, I didn't create that policy. Sure. I wasn't alive when the GI, you know, like I wasn't part of that. So how can I be part of the problem or why do I need to own that?
Yeah.
And I think that gets to the allergy against structures and systems that you were talking about, where I think, and individualism, honestly, like I think of myself as such an individual that sort of just emerged out of nothing, you know, who just has ideas that, you know, that I'm not affected by anything, you know, that it doesn't feel like I should have to take responsibility for some of those things when, you know, it's just, it's a really strong conceptual tool that insulates us from doing what would be required to bring justice, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Well, this is, you know, this is half formed and that's something I'm kind of working out right now. So I hope, you know, I can do that safely here. And if not, you all can
edit. This podcast is half-formed speculation.
Oh, good.
Over half-formed things. We're just like, hey, I'm going to try out something and we're going to record it and release it to the world. And if it's heresy,
someone will
forgive
let you
me.
Know.
Yeah, forgive me. Sure, I'll repent later. Anyway, well, go ahead.
Here's what I'm working out. Over the past month, I've had multiple white people say to me, I just didn't know. Mm. And they're appealing to their own ignorance as a way of saying, now that I do know, I'm going to do better.
Yeah.
And I get that. Like, I understand that for each of us, there is this, each of us who are white, there is this kind of waking up that happens. So I do think that's a stage, right? But at some point, I think spiritual maturity for white Christians requires that we say, not just I didn't know, but I chose not to know. I willfully didn't know. I was content in my ignorance.
Yes.
If we don't do that, then what are we saying about all of the other moments of profound suffering that have been evident in this country? Like, what was that death not enough? Was that instance of police brutality not enough? You know what I mean? So this is what I'm trying to figure out right now. Like, how do we as white Christians talk about our own ignorance and how we're waking up to that, but then go deeper and say that, you know, our confession has to include the fact that we wanted that we were okay, that we were complicit with our own ignorance. And then if we say that, then we also have to say complicit then with the suffering of sisters and brothers of color who suffered under that ignorance.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you, so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
Part of this for white people, at least for me, is it was convenient for me to so go back to normal. Yeah. It was convenient for me to, you know, to just sort of avoid the risk of putting my body on the line, stepping out in some way in solidarity. And there was real fear in that for me. You know what I mean? Like realizing there was a strong sense of fear of what the ramifications of my solidarity would mean for me and for my family and for our comfort, you know, and that kind of thing. So,
I fear think that's and right like on. What were you, what did you feel afraid of?
I felt afraid of, I guess just, white people. Like I felt afraid of racists sort of attacking me.
Mm-hmm. White fragility. You know?
I was afraid of other white people noticing that and turning on me.
Like the backlash.
And that, the backlash and that, I don't know what form that would take, but it was just, you know, it's like a visceral fear in my body of like, oh, I don't want that. I don't want, you know, people to vandalize my home if they know that I'm marched in this thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I guess there's an awareness of there, like, but I hear you of saying like, then for me, it's not enough to say, oh yeah, I didn't know. I mean, I have known,
right.
But also to say, yeah. And there was a real fear in me and that's why I didn't step out. And that did directly contribute over the past whatever years, since I did sort of have an inkling of what was going on, it did contribute to the suffering of my Black brothers and sisters.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, as you guys are talking, I'm thinking of what contributes to this complicity. And David, I want to move into the second half of your book where you actually lay out some key practices to disciple us out of this racial ignorance, racial disparity. But I'm thinking about how, you know, 70 years ago, there were explicit laws that were racist. There were signs on water fountains, right? So like our racism was explicit and blatant and we like reveled in it, right? And what's happened over the last 70 years is that racism has gone out of fashion. And so we've had to drive it underground and make it hidden in secret. So that we're not outraged or scandalized by our complicity in it. So we use coded language like law and order, right? And then we can tell ourselves a story about that coded language that excludes racism, even though it's explicitly racist. So as I think about how long it took me to unravel this, it was, you know, Breonna Taylor gets shot in her house. And I'm like, man, that's too bad. Or I wonder if they found drugs or, you know what I mean? Or, boy, who does your boyfriend have a record? Probably should think about having a better boyfriend if you don't want to be executed in your home in the middle of the night. You know what I mean? Like, so all these stories that keep me from reckoning with the data and the way we're talking about, and just noticing how those stories contribute with kind of this willful hiddenness of white supremacy in our culture. And once you begin to see it, I mean, it's a reason why they use the word woke. It's like you begin to see it everywhere. And it's devastating. It's devastating.
And my sense about this is that, again, I'm a Christian, right? So I try to think about this through that lens. This white innocence, the sense of our own innocence runs really, really deep. And how incompatible is that with the gospel, right? Like the gospel that we proclaim, you know, the grace that we say that we are utterly dependent on, is incompatible with that sense of, and it's a form of self-righteousness, right? Like somehow I'm exempt from this. Somehow I've not been tainted by this. And I do think that that's part of what we need to think about when we're thinking about discipling actual white women and men. Part of that discipleship is leading them away from that deep sense of their own innocence. Mm. Now, part of that requires that we help. I mean, Matt's talking about the stories that we tell. Right. We need to tell the truer story, right? We need to tell the truer historical story, and how that intersects with our own sort of Christian story. But we got to move people away from that sense of innocence, because it, as long as we're fighting for that, then we are willfully not going to see the kinds of truth that yeah. we have.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's been a part of my formation as a leader and a disciple maker, trying to call, predominantly white church that we pastor, mm-hmm. calling people into that, is realizing that one of the ways that I was, formed in racism was that I'm very concerned about hurting white people's feelings, mm-hmm. or the fact, that bruising their egos a little bit. I'm more concerned about that than I am about speaking the yeah. truth. And so yeah. I've had to realize that and say, no, this needs to be said. Yeah. I don't know how people are going to react, and I'm not trying to be I'm not, but I'm,
this is your journey. This is your story here.
I'm trying to preach the truth, about what's happening and one of the things I realized is that I am very concerned about hurting white people's feelings.
I do think that is, again, that's one of those characteristics of our racial discipleship.
Yes.
Comfort and safety are some of our highest values, right? And then that gets subsumed into our Christianity.
Yes.
And so this is one of the weird things about white Christianity, is that that we are one of the only groups of people who somehow think that following Jesus is about comfort. Our own safety and security, right? That is not the experience of pretty much any other group of Christians in the world, including in our own country, right? And so in our congregation, we have Black and brown people who sort of inherently understand that discomfort is part of how the Holy Spirit works, that even times of suffering and even injustice can still be places where God works in a powerful way for you, intercedes in your life, moves things around. Mm-hmm. Those of us who are white, on the other hand, how do we experience those moments? I got to get out of here as quickly as possible. We got to do whatever is necessary, to return to that sense of equilibrium.
Yeah.
And so, one of the things that I'm constantly wrestling with, and I don't think I do this all that well, is when I stand before my own congregation, how do I keep white people at the table mm-hmm. without in any way dishonoring the people of color in our church? Mm. And that is something that only the Holy Spirit can do, right? That balance, given our racial formation, is impossible, I think, under our own strength. But simply holding that in my own kind of heart and mind, I think allows some space for the Holy Spirit to do what only God can do in that point. If God's going to be moving in all of our lives, despite that kind of formation we're talking about.
Yeah. And I think that's an important thing to remember as well as leaders, is the point isn't hey, go offend as many white people as you can. That's not the point.
Nope.
I think there is a pastoral sensitivity required to say, you said, keeping them at the table. It does require recognizing, okay, I'm worried about hurting their feelings. And I know that them in their formation right now, getting their feelings hurt or having their comfort disrupted, it feels like one of the worst things that could happen to them. Mm-hmm. And so this is going to feel very threatening. Mm-hmm. And so I need to just take that into account as I proclaim the truth, as I speak to them, as I disciple them. You have to consider it as mm-hmm. from a pastoral perspective. Yeah.
And David, this is why your book is so important and helpful. And it's because maybe primarily for many white Christians, the voices that they're listening to learn about racism are not Christian voices.
Yeah.
So they're people outside the church who are naming a justice issue for people inside the church. And then people inside the church are trying to adopt that justice issue, but sometimes they get labeled as, Marxists or whatever, right? And so the biblical theological work that you are doing is vital. And so I'd love to pivot for the last part of this interview to the second half of the book, where you describe, here's what true solidarity means. And it's all about discipleship. Mm-hmm. And your chapters are seven practices that get us into true solidarity. And I'd just love to maybe mention, I'm going to mention them, and then I'd love to talk about two of them if that's okay, because people need to buy this book. The seven practices are table fellowship, kingdom preaching, subversive liturgies, Children's Ministry of Reconciliation, Practicing Presence, Salvation from Superiority, and Uncommon Friendship. Maybe just to intro this, how did these begin to take shape? Where did these come from for you? How did you discover these?
Yeah, so a couple things. One, I hate reading books that make me feel like I have to completely reinvent the wheel because I just don't have the energy for that anymore. And so I really did. I wanted to write something where ministry leaders and pastors felt like, okay, this is asking me to reimagine what we're already doing rather than throwing everything out and starting from scratch. So that's a part of it. But the second is that any kind of re-discipling is going to have to address those three characteristics of white Christianity that we talked about earlier. And I think the corporate practices of the church are ripe for that. They're latent with that potential. So intentionally embracing the fact that we need to think about our systems and structures, intentionally thinking that or thinking that we have to move beyond just one-on-one relationships, intentionally thinking that we've got to think corporately rather than just individuals.
Great. And I think what you're naming there, naming these things as practices as well, is really helpful, because I think one of the things that, you know, I've noticed that we do in the West, and maybe this is a white thing, I'm not sure, but one of the things we do is we've noticed a problem and we think we can teach our way out of it.
Yes.
If we do a sermon series on how individualism and relationalism and anti-structuralism, yep, how they're bad, yep, three week sermon series, that'll solve it.
Good. Yep.
But that's not going to do it. We actually have to inhabit some practices.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I've said this so many times in my own sermons, you know, if you just really, really believed this, then that's not how human beings work, right? You know, I mean, our beliefs matter, but
right. Take some time and believe it harder right now.
That's
in
right.
your mind, right?
Then you're going to be fine the rest of the week, you know, if only. That's
Yeah, David. So the two I want to chat about more are subversive liturgies and, Salvation from Superiority. I just pivoted and I decided to talk about that one instead of another one because they're all incredible. So Ben and I are in the Anglican tradition. We've got a Book of Common Prayer. Mm-hmm. This prayer book was developed initially to bring something ancient out of touch into a context that could be, so you didn't have to know Latin. You could say it in your language, right? So there's a contextualization of liturgy happening at the founding of our tradition. And now there's talk in Christian circles about the phrase I hear is decolonizing the liturgy, right? I would love it if you could speak a bit about, I don't think you use that phrase, but you do talk about subversive liturgy. And I wonder what the similarities are between those two things and how you've worked that out on the ground in your church.
Yep. I'm not in any way an expert on decolonization, especially when it comes to theology. I'm going to be talking to Randy Woodley today, who's an indigenous leader who's recently written a book on decolonizing evangelicalism. So I'll have maybe better thoughts later on today about this. But when I'm thinking about what I'm thinking about what the liturgy can do, right? Like I think, so I'm not high church. I'm not Anglican. I'm relatively low church in my formation and continue to be to this day. But I have a high appreciation for the liturgy and for the Sunday morning liturgy, and what it is meant to do. Right? This is how we pray with our bodies as a people, as a community, not simply as individuals. This is how we together, and this is the key thing for me. This is how we together inhabit the narrative, the story of scriptures. To think about kind of how Robert Weber talks about this. And to pray with our bodies together. I just am not sure that we have emphasized that note strongly enough in the white American context. I think that many of us who kind of run through our liturgies, on, regardless of sort of how they're structured or not, are still experiencing them on a very, very individual level. We come to them with our own individual questions. So what I want to try to do in that chapter is ask, like, how could we hit that note of koinonia and fellowship louder so that how we come to the liturgy and what we're expecting the liturgy to do to us in the gathering, in the praying, in the coming to table, you know, in the passing of the peace, etc., that we are actually anticipating that this thing is forming us together. So I had a sabbatical, it feels like a decade ago. I think it was just a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. And so for a month, I attended one of my friend's church here in the neighborhood, and he pastors a Church of God in Christ Church, which, if you know sort of, you know, your charismatic history, this was the black, you know, church that went in one direction after the Azusa yeah. Street revival. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very charismatic congregation. And, you know, I love it. Absolutely love being with them. And one of the things that you will sometimes hear leaving that church after being sent, after receiving the benediction is, you know, we had some church today. and to me, that's a subtle thing, but it's the difference between how many white people leave church and saying, well, what did you think about the sermon today? You know, mm-hmm. and what did you think about the children's message today? What did you think yeah. about the hymn selection today? It's cognitive, it's individual, it's evaluative, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas, yeah. you know, many of the congregation members leaving my friend's church are they're located within a community. Their anticipation as they come to church is we are coming together. We had an experience of this racist society this week that in some ways shared similarities. Now we're coming together to church, anticipating together a word from God, a move from God that we can then celebrate together. I think that that language betrays a really important difference that goes beyond some kind of a, well, this culture talks about it this way, this culture talks about it that way. That's what I'm trying to get my hands around in that chapter about liturgy. What would we need to do and adjust and reimagine so that the people coming to our, you know, predominantly white churches are saying, we're coming together. We were formed together this week as white people. We were deformed together this week. And so we are hungry and thirsty to be put back together. So I'm starting to preach right now. So let me pull it back just a little. You know, we need to be put back together by the liturgy, by how we pray, we sing, we worship together,
yes. Yes.
and have this corporate experience of the power of God together, and then yes. be resent out into a world that is going to, again, try to be deforming us.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's the difference between, sort of observing something, thinking of yourself as apart from something that I'm looking at, evaluating, thinking about, allowing in to a certain degree, and mm-hmm. maybe not if it's not my cup mm-hmm. of tea or mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. rather than the posture of I'm all in, I'm part of this body for good or for ill, you know. With the people that annoy me, and you know, I'm disappointed that person's preaching today. But like, mm-hmm. but we're part of this. We're having church today.
Yeah,
that's yeah, right. yeah. That's right. That is a big difference. I wonder. I want to get to the other practice you want to talk about, Matt, in a second. But we're recording this during COVID, Coronatide, as yes. we call it, yes. In our church. And I wonder if you have, maybe you don't have, I mean, this, you know, you probably couldn't have anticipated this writing your book, but like, I wonder if you have thoughts about, because we've been wrestling with this. We've been on, you know, Zoom mm-hmm. for church for, I don't know, 15 weeks now or something like that. And you know, a lot of what you just talked about is like, my heart hurts right now because I'm like, that's what I want to get back to. But like, it's so hard to know, you know, when that's going to be safe and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I don't know if you have thoughts about that. It's made us realize that we miss it, but it's also made us realize like, man, it was powerfully formative for us. And we're trying to figure out how that can happen now.
Yeah. I have maybe two thoughts. One, I do think for many white Christians, this experience is latent with possibility. I've watched the ways that our white members and then many of our members of color are experiencing this moment. And to make a massive generalization, what I have found is that many of our members of color, and black members in particular, have a sort of access to a memory of God's faithfulness during times in the wilderness that many of our white members simply do not have. And so even the imagination of the individual members, you know, of who God is for us now and what God is doing now is different. And so I've come to be somewhat hopeful that one of the results of this time, one of the discipling results of this time can be that wilderness experience. We're not trying to just get through this, but we actually expect yes. God to be here in the wilderness, forming us, discipling us, shaping us right now. So I would want to be looking for that. If I'm serving in a predominantly white church, I would want to be looking for how are we doing that? How are we teaching? How are we, you know, how are we preaching? What are the notes that we are trying to sound? around? What are the stories that we're telling, the testimonies that we're sharing? Where in history are we drawing from to talk about similar times when God has been faithful to his people? That's one. The second, and we're struggling with this, but we're trying to find every way possible to put community members from our church in front of the camera. We're doing the live thing on Sunday mornings. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this coming Sunday, we're going to show pictures of, you know, all of the students in our church who are advancing from one grade to the next. We serve, you know, high school students in the neighborhood. They didn't get to have their celebrations this year, so we took their pictures and they're holding up their signs. We're going to celebrate all of them. Anything that we can do to push against the individualism that I think this moment is engendering us, I think is actually, and sacrificing some technical prowess for the sake of that is worth in my mind, right? Like, let that be messy in order to keep people in front of each other at this time.
Yeah.
Dude.
Man, that's so helpful. Thank you.
Yep. It's super helpful. We only have time for one more, but you described this salvation from superiority. David, most white people don't realize that we think we're superior to everyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you come to see that in your life, and what have you done to dismantle it?
I think there was no one moment for me. I think a long process that mostly involved proximity, mostly involved people who are willing to tell me the truth. You know, reading what I have access to and kind of chasing down those rabbit trails. I do think, though, a really big part of it for me is theological. Like, I believe I'm a sinner. I really do believe that. You know, I say this to my church. I'll say, you know, imagine I'm standing in front of 100, 120 people, about a third of those are white, third of those Asian American, third of those are black. I will say, I breathe this racist air. What that means is that there will be times when I say or do something that has been infected by that racist. I will be racist in some ways. And when that happens, when I do that, I'm asking you to tell me so that I have the opportunity to confess that and to be reconciled and to receive your forgiveness. So it's still hard, right? Like, I still don't like that reality, but I actually believe that's true. So I think for me, it's not a leap to once I kind of understand history to go, well, yeah, clearly I'm going to be impacted by that. Why in the world would I be exempt from that? And as a Christian, I don't know of any better way to think about dismantling any of this than to move away from the lean towards self-righteousness and instead lean really hard into repentance. Like, I think about this a lot in church settings, you know, because I'm a church planter. And oftentimes church planters are starting churches because they're reacting to something, right? They had a bad experience of some kind, so we're going to do it different. I think that's actually really a dangerous tendency if we don't interrogate it a little bit, right? Because if now we're doing it right, then we are immune to anybody telling us that we've hurt them, that we've wounded them in some ways, right? Like, our salvation has come from, we're the ones who've gotten it right. When again, as Christian people, our salvation comes from confessing and acknowledging that we get it wrong all the time, that we sin all the time. So that, I think when it comes to white people acknowledging our own tendencies towards superiority, it's the same thing. It's just admitting, like, yeah, of course, of course.
Yeah, I think it's hard for white people to, I'm speaking as a white person, so I see you white people. But it's hard for us to reckon with, we can be culpable, complicit, and cooperate with things we didn't volitionally choose. Because this, it's such a strong assumption that undergirds our culture. Like, you know, people describe it different ways. You talk about individual, I'm the sum of my individual choices.
Right.
Or meritocracy. People get what they deserve. And I've made good choices, so I deserve good things. And you've made bad choices, so you deserve bad things.
Yeah.
And it's a fundamental shift in how you see the world to reckon with, I did not intend to be superior over anyone.
Sure.
And I'm superior over most everyone. You almost need to get saved for that to happen.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so that's in that chapter on salvation, it's probably the most far out there one for me, because I just haven't seen this one yet. Mm. What we see instead with white Christians is this sort of second conversion to racial justice, right? We say yes to Jesus, and at some point down the road, we have the second conversion. I just wonder, what would it look like for a mostly white church in its efforts to proclaiming the gospel to other white people to acknowledge this as one of the things that we need to be saved from, so that a person who's coming to Jesus for the first time, who's starting to follow Jesus for the first time, understands that this is part of it. I've not seen that a whole lot yet, but wouldn't that be amazing if that was just part of our discipleship right from the beginning, and we didn't have to have these sort of like second awakenings? I realize we're always waking up to more and more of the implications of following Jesus.
Sure.
I get that. But in our American context, it just seems to me, man, that should be one of the ones from jump that we understand we need salvation from.
Yeah, dude. Yeah.
So good. I wish we had time to unpack all these practices. We don't. And then we also want to commend this book heartily.
I appreciate that.
I think, I mean, like I said this before, we desperately need the deconstruction of white supremacy to be married with our discipleship as we follow Jesus. Mm. And they're not two separate projects.
That's right.
It's we're doing, as Christians who follow Jesus, we're doing one thing. Mm-hmm. So
that's right.
Right. And so I think your book does much needed work, David, to hold those things that can seem disparate, that our culture wants to make disparate, together, and shows that there's congruence and alignment with a theological and biblical tradition.
Yeah.
And the trajectory of new creation and where we're all headed.
Yes. Can I say one thing about that real quick, Matt?
Yeah.
You know, especially if there's some pastors listening to this right now, one of the real sad things about not holding this together is younger white people who start to wake up to the realities of racial injustice and then go, well, what else hasn't my church told me? You know, what else is my church complicit with? Yeah. And I've had way too many of those conversations with younger white Christians, and I've seen way too many younger white Christians walk away from faith to pursue racial justice.
Right.
And seeing the two and man, is there anything more heartbreaking than that? And so again, if we can actually hold together what was never meant to be separated in this way, we're doing a really important service for a younger generation in particular, I think.
Yeah. And you may have to be willing to have some very difficult conversations with older members of your congregation who think you're turning into a Marxist or whatever challenge they're going to give you. Yeah. But hey, if you want to, you know, if you want those young people to stick around, for no other reason, you just want young people to stick around, like, take this seriously.
Yeah. I had a message in my DMs. I've tried to speak up a little more on Facebook recently. It's one of the places I get to touch people that I'm just not around locally. And, you know, Facebook's a complicated mess. But it's also, and it's an evil company, but it's also a place where you can actually touch people that are translocal. And I had a girl who's an atheist. She's a woman now, but she was in my youth group. She was a girl then. And she's like, hey, I'm an atheist and I left the church, but, thank you so much for speaking up as a Christian about this stuff. And I think we have not reckoned with how many young people have left the Christian church because not only do they not care about this stuff, but they're cooperating and even advocating for it.
Yeah.
You know, they laugh at Kung Flu jokes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we're blaspheming the Holy Spirit when we do that.
Yeah, that's right.
And unbelievers can see it better than us. So all I have to say is we need a way out of that and a forward. And I think you do that. The book then is called, once again, Rediscipling the White Church, From Cheap Diversity to True Solidarity by David W. Swanson. David, if people are stirred, if their hearts are strangely warmed listening to you talk about this, where can they connect with you maybe online?
I have a pretty simple website, dwswanson.com, and everything kind of links from there. So that'd be great.
dwswanson.com. Awesome. All right. David, thanks for your time. Hey, enjoy that conversation later that you mentioned.
Yeah.
I'm a little envious of that. I'd like to listen in or hear what
it'll be on. It'll live on Facebook for forever. So you can find it.
It's going to be on Facebook. Great.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Great.
Yeah. Great. We'll all right. Thanks, David.
Appreciate peace to you. Both. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.